Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. Who's here?
Hi, Dave. It's Grace. I'm here.
Grace, welcome. Looking forward to hearing your roadmap case study.
Yes, yes.
How was it for you writing it up and doing it? Did you do it on a client or yourself?
Myself.
Okay. How did you
find it? I know the sample is a new money. Created a new life story rather than a new money story.
That's great. Whatever aspect you decide to do it on, it's totally up to you.
Yeah.
Did you find that it was helpful in applying some things we've been talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
Okay, well, super. Well, any other wins or progress notes for you from the week?
Well, I was away for about a week and was certified for a completion process, as a completion process practitioner. So it's like I'm able to marry both, you know, like do, and I will talk about that in
what
I want to do, and that is
specifically.
Pardon me?
What was the certification specifically?
It's called completion process practitioner, completion process. And what it is to assist one in finding what an old trauma or a childhood trauma that remains to be repeated in a life pattern, a defeating life pattern, or unable to proceed. And so it's kind of like an interior cleaning, and then to put the new life story. It just seems to work well together.
How does it fit with, it seems like a different philosophy that we're talking about here, that getting back into an old story is an indication, a sign to get present and to create new neural associations rather than going back into it, exploring it, understanding, resolving it, and that sort of thing. How are you bringing the two together?
Well, maybe I think it would probably be best for me to go to the roadmap.
Oh, okay, great. All right, well,
yeah,
that'd be good.
And then
I'll look forward to that.
Explain that.
Okay, excellent. That'll be a treat then. So I'm curious, and we'll be listening for if you see them as contradictory or complementary.
No, not at all.
That'll be very interesting.
Yeah, not at all, because it's more like, well, it's pretty much also the process that I was doing in creating my new life story. It's an interior psychological story, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's not just going to the logic of, okay, this is who we are now. It's creating a new psychological experience, which I think is better for the brain to grab a hold of than a logical story.
Yes, okay. Well, it'll be really interesting listening to that then. Super. Look forward to it. Thanks for the preview. Great. Excellent. How are you poised and thinking about how you're going to integrate the two to do practice, and how you're going to practice, if it's going to be a coaching practice or a therapy practice? Or,
you know, I think it will be two, even though I say it's a 1-2, you know, it's like a 2-step process. They really are two different processes, you know. So I could say that along with being an author and a public speaker, which are in the process, you know, of being created, I am a life coach also, as well as a completion process practitioner. And I can use, those are like different tools in my toolbox, you know, and I can use both in the same client, but I may not.
I think one note here, and this will be maybe a separate discussion, but I think you have to really distinguish whether it's coaching or therapy, because it's an entirely different framework, licensure, and legal entity of doing therapy versus doing coaching. And if any of you have looked, and you're welcome to use my client intake pack as much as you'd like. It's in the curriculum as well as on my website. You'll notice, in the curriculum, it's not as specific. On my website, the agreement clearly spells out that this is mentor coaching. It is not therapy or psychoanalysis in any way, and is not, medical insurance does not apply. So you have to create a very clear boundary there between.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, I think I don't know if there are other people in the group now, or I seem to be doing all the talking. Sorry. Are there?
Go ahead and finish your thought, and then I'll check in with everybody else.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, when I was learning about Jung, and Jung is really part of my training. In fact, I write about him in my dissertation, and I have a big essay on him as part of my dissertation. But one thing I noticed about Jung is that, his is therapy, and his is a lengthy process, very lengthy and very expensive process. But what attracts me with a completion process is it is not a therapy in terms of like what you and Carl Jung were doing. Those are lengthy processes, So
okay,
even though it does take part of his thing, and that is the like active imagination. Which is what I use to create.
Okay,
and
my only point, just so I'm clear, and then I'll move on, is the framework needs to be established with a contractual agreement with a client about whether you're engaged in therapy or coaching. And if it's coaching, it needs to be clear with the client agreeing and recognizing that in writing that they're not doing therapy or counseling. And the form I'm using has had a couple of attorneys vet it. It's just a really pristine thing that in coaching we don't get sued for malpractice. I've never heard of anything. But you have to really distinguish therapy from coaching and to be clear about what you are and aren't doing. So just a note. So,
a very good point.
Thanks, Grace. Look forward to hearing your case report. Who's next? Wins progress notes. Who else is here? Is Stephanie here? What about Grace?
That's me.
I'm sorry. What about Anne-Marie?
Oh, that's funny.
What about
Amy? You and me.
Okay. Anything else you would like to talk about before doing your roadmap case study? We're being recorded, so the others will listen. So they'll hear it, even if they, don't show. So anything else that?
By the way, talking about recording, Dave, we don't have somehow because I was not in last week. I attempted to go into the playback, and there is none. It's like the link is not working this time. So it does not go.
Okay, if you have trouble accessing it, send an email to bill@coachtrainingalliance.com.
Okay.
And he's the IT guy, and he'll help you get connected. He should be posting them like within 24 hours of our class, but if you have trouble in any kind of technical problems, contact Bill. Bill@coachtrainingalliance.com.
Yeah. I actually had contacted him once before.
Okay,
yes.
he'll be happy to help you. Yeah, well,
yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that. If you're having
So it's like something broke down in the link.
Okay. Yeah, they're having some troubles at CTA, and Bill's server is having some trouble. So it could be that, but he'll be able to address that because he still gets email. He's in the process of correcting that. So what do you envision then, Grace, with your practice? How do you think about developing a practice? Or is that a goal?
Well, I do want to incorporate, well, rather than, like I said, rather than mixing the two, I think the two are separate, you know, items, and perhaps apples and oranges, you know. So I do want to, like, who am I, you know, I am this, and I am a life coach, as well as a completion process practitioner. And so I guess that completion process does not have to even come into the picture here. Life coaching can be totally separate, but I do for my own life want to incorporate that because it's just something really brief. I like modalities that can give people relief and transformational,
yeah.
And yet at the same time, it's a short process,
See,
you know.
One thing that I want to play back a little bit about what I'm hearing you say, when I ask you about your practice, you began to talk about theories and different modalities, and I'm really speaking of, is your practice going to be professional coaching or is it therapy? And with a practice, how would you represent that and who will be your niche market that you'll develop first? So that's something to think about independently of theoretical framework and integration of a plurality of disciplines and that sort of thing, because to think of your practice as a business and to look at who's your niche and how do you get clients and how do you define and frame the context of what you're doing. Is it coaching? And if so, then it would need to be clear that it's not therapy. Now, your group, the completion process practitioners, do they have a network? Will you be getting referrals from them? How does that work?
We can get referrals from them if we wanted. Meaning,
how
if we wanted, you can.
How do they generate referrals to pass to you?
Well, they have a website, and the person that created this training is a spiritual teacher, Teal Swan,
okay.
And she has a website. And she used to practice this herself, and so now she is training other people because she's not able to do that anymore. She's creating workshops and lecturing, teaching the world around the world, you know.
Okay. All right, super. I'll check in to see if anyone else has arrived after you do your case study, but go ahead and begin your roadmap case study, Grace.
Okay. You said 8 pages. No, you said 8 minutes, so I created double-spaced, so that should be about 8 minutes. Okay, so my roadmap is for a new life story. The philosopher Schopenhauer says that as one looks back later in life, one sees a pattern unfolding, much like the plot of a novel in which events that seemed entirely accidental or incidental turn out to have been central to the composition. Who, Schopenhauer asks, composed the plot? He posits that just like our dreams, our lives are directed by what he calls the will, the self of which we are largely unconscious. We have been, he says, dreamers of our own lives, like Vishnu on his seven-headed serpent. Little did we know that we are that mysterious creator of our own will. We are the composers of the plots of our own life stories. When one looks at the broad strokes of my life, one sees a powerful story. A little girl awakened to consciousness, living in a broken-down, one-room thatched shack with her parents and 3 siblings. 2 more siblings would join them in that hovel, and two more later on in another house. But just as life was beginning to take turn for the better, her mother, who worked in a shoe factory sewing leather upper for women's shoes, died when she was 8 years old. She felt alone and abandoned in this world because her father could not take care of her and her siblings on his own. She and her siblings moved in with an aunt and uncle who were mean and cruel to them. At age 19, she decided to leave town to find her destiny, to finish her last 2 years of college from a prestigious university to compete for better-paying jobs. Her uncle beat her up for wanting to leave, breaking three leather belts on her body, but she managed to leave and graduate from a prestigious university and acquire that well-paying job. She returns to share her boon of abundance to help educate her siblings. That was my first heroine's journey, which was a run from poverty. I would later have other successes in life, motherhood. I raised three successful human beings, all with advanced degrees and serving others in their careers. In business, I supported these children as a single mother, providing for them as a real estate broker and investor. After I was done raising my children, I ventured into one more journey to find my writer self and ended up with a master's degree in English creative writing and a PhD in mythological studies with emphasis in depth psychology. So it seemed like the story is a fairy tale. So what's the problem? I had to find the underlying story that, despite the obvious successes, had undermined my journey in life. Because I want to succeed one more time at this journey later in life, to assume my destiny in life, I need to face that shadow story. Based on my experience of losing my mother when I was 8, I determined that I was alone and that life was an overwhelming struggle and that I better fend for myself on my own. Also, as a result of living with my aunt and uncle who abused us, I identified with the story of being abused, oppressed, and therefore second rate. I was always told I was not good enough, and because we were not loved, we siblings identified with the story of being unlovable. Even though in response I wanted to prove them wrong and fought for a better life, I had internalized an inner story of low self-esteem, which is probably why I had to cover it up with achievements. Later in life, as I looked into the depths of my soul, I realized that I have to change the way I look at myself if I want to find my highest and best self. And so the search for the new story, for a new story. So the first step in the roadmap is recognize authorship. I am now aware that no matter what anybody says of me, I am the one that ultimately buys the story by identifying with the story. I see my childhood differently now. If I was the one that created that old story, then I am also the one that can create a new story. Next step is to own your own story. It is painful to realize that even though I fought all along for a better life and at times thought of myself as a little train that could, I also identified with being a victim. Even though I had always referred to myself as having been provided for by the universe, the underlying story of being alone in life frequently brought me to a state of overwhelm, especially at the onset of a journey. My identification with being oppressed and second-rate was all my doing. My life was unnecessarily hard because of the position I took. I could have spared myself the emotional pain had I not used the story of being oppressed to propel me to success. Assess the plot and storylines. I realize now that my attitude of being alone in the world has hurt me. I left two marriages and have been single and living alone longer than I care to admit. I realize that if I want to create a relationship and a life partner, which is my desire, I need to let go of the old story. Even though I did a stellar job with providing for my children in a different way than I was raised in my childhood, life could have been easier for me had I had a life partner doing it with. With my PhD, I decided not to teach in the academic setting, in an academic setting. Because I was always an entrepreneur most of my working life, I want to create a new business that allows me to be my ultimate self. I can teach others as an author. I want to publish the 2 books of my dissertation and to continue to write. I can also teach as a public speaker, as a life coach, and as a completion process practitioner. But these are lofty goals that I cannot reach while hiding in the old story. Next step is decide what to change. I need to let go of the victim mentality and all the negative associations such as not being enough or not being lovable. I have to stop acquiring more trainings because I have enough and I am enough. This is hard to accept that despite my achievements, I have this sad story underneath it all. I need to revise my memoir and make it be about a journey to wholeness rather than to show that I was a victim that managed to acquire all these achievements. I want to become not only a life coach but a spiritual teacher, so I have to shed all identifications of being a lowly person. I must become a new being. I am a new being. Map changes. I know now what I want to do in life. My new business name is Grace Hogstead, PhD. In that capacity, I am author, public speaker, completion process practitioner, and life coach. This is the ideal life that I want to have. In these roles, I am more teacher of living life well rather than a teacher of how to make money, even though money is definitely welcome. Author new experiences. I have arrived at a new life story because I went inward and created a new psychological experience which the brain can accept as a real experience. The intensity of the emotion involved as I create the new experience helped to make the new story real. The old story is dropped after creating a new story that is different than the one I remembered and identified with. Program new experiences and identity. I sustain the new story by going inward and process my feelings every time I find myself identifying with the old feelings and triggers. I then remind myself of my new story and my new identity. As I work on getting the 2 books of my dissertation published, and as I create more public speaking opportunities by lecturing on my dissertation, on the themes of destiny and the heroine's journey, I take on life coaching clients. But the kind of practice I envision is not just to help one launch a career or business, but to help one create one's destiny. It is a two-step process, first by assisting them in a completion process. As a certified completion process practitioner, I can help clients go inward and find a childhood trauma that is causing them to be stuck in life or to repeat patterns that sabotage the goals they have in life. After the completion process, I can help guide them in doing or finding what they want to do in life or what they are meant to do in life. That's the end.
Congratulations. Thank you. That was really a powerful piece of work.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. Want to open up. Has anyone else arrived? When I checked earlier, Anne Marie, Emmy, and Stephanie were not here yet. Has anyone arrived? Okay, we'll carry on. Grace, is there one sentence that you could use to describe what the completion process does?
Okay.
is there a way to describe that in a single sentence?
Okay. When one is upset or triggered, so rather than avoiding, I don't know if I can do the as brief as you want, rather than avoiding the feeling, one sinks into the feeling. And sinking into the feeling to really see how that feels, to be with the feeling. And then association, then, let's see, go into the feeling, and then one is asked, or let me just do that on myself. Say for example, if I'm feeling off and triggered, I would go into the feeling rather than avoiding the feeling, and then really go into the sensations of the feeling, and then I ask myself, when's the last time I felt this way, or when's the first time I felt this way? And rather than letting the mind, look for the answer, allow the being to come up with the answer, and a memory will come, and or maybe not sometimes, you know, but then one can come up with a childhood trauma. And something as simple as, for example, you know, I was left alone in a crib for a long time. I was hungry, you know, in my case, for example, I was able to recall being hungry because my mother and father left my aunt and uncle's house after I was born, and I was hungry, and my mother was hungry, you know. And so that is kind of part of what drives my life, you know, the overwhelm of, oh, how am I going to live? How am I going to make it? Oh, my God, this world is so difficult, you know.
May I coach you for a moment, Grace?
Sure.
Okay. I'm listening, when I ask that question, I'm listening from the standpoint of a potential client. Now,
yes.
I hear an elaboration of a process that I, as a client, get into all the time, let's say, that there's trigger, and I'm back into that state. I'm back into the memories. I can't get out of it. I can't stop remembering. I'm still listening here a few minutes later for the one sentence that I'm looking for that will help me sign on with you.
Oh,
as,
I see.
As a
that
practitioner,
was a question.
How am I going to change my brain? You know, the one thing, and now I'm back into this is me, Dave. The one thing, if you look at all the therapies, all the different models of coaching, all the counseling, all the different kinds of intervention, there is one thing that any one of them that actually works has in common. And that's that they create neural reconditioning. They associate, they create a different association to the meaning that's attached to whatever event it is. And I would say what we do here in this work is we have a system to address that, the roadmap system, and particularly the four-column approach of looking at what the different emotional cues or triggers are, to recognize that early in the process, as early as possible, then to get grounded and move into the new story, the ideal behavior, and repeating that enough creates direct neural reconditioning. So I'm still listening. Can you at this point in one sentence say what is the healing aspect of completion process practitioner in one sentence? Because if
okay.
you can't say it in one sentence, it's going to leave a lot of questions.
Okay. Finding an old trauma that repeats in the pattern that one is stuck in, finding that would allow you to become unstuck and be able to move on with life.
What if I know the pattern? I mean, what if I know the trauma? I've been repeating the same thing with different people all my life. I know the trauma very well. I recreate it every day. What good is knowing that going to do for me? How would you respond to that? You knew your pattern. I mean, you knew your trauma. You weren't amnestic for the childhood trauma early on. So how did you? What was different? Just if you can say that succinctly, because I'll really get it if you can say it in 10 or 12 words or less. You remember from the studies.
Okay. Sorry. What was the question again?
What?
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Curative? What's the change factor? You knew your trauma. You weren't amnestic to the trauma. What did you use using that modality to change?
Well, I think you're presuming that one knows the pattern.
Well,
one might
know
not
your,
know
you didn't
the
know
pattern.
Yours. You didn't know that you had that childhood trauma and that you'd been repeating it with the same internal story?
Well, I've already done some inner work myself, so
okay.
I know, but not all of it, you know.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
I get it. Well, thank you for engaging with me. I wanted to be clear about it myself and to really see what the interface might be or the integration might be with what we're doing and get an appreciation.
I mean, and like I'm saying, you know, I'm naming those two things separately, or I will be in what I do.
Okay.
So life coaching, and even though in my mind I'm kind of connecting them,
yeah.
But it really isn't. You know, one is a separate process,
and I wanted to explore from a theoretical and a practical perspective. As you know, I integrate a whole number of theories and disciplines and approaches.
Oh yeah,
so,
yeah, and you said the right you said
so
the
I
word
to
integration.
See what kind of offering this might have to further expand what we're doing. So
yeah,
thank you for going into that.
Yeah, integration. In fact, it's you know, we kind of have this image of a river, and a river when one experiences a trauma, that part, you know, and it's denied and suppressed, and so that part is split off, and so when you reintegrate it back, you have, as you know, as a psychoanalyst, you know that you have more energy or libido left for the rest of life because
yeah.
you have owned up to parts of you that has been disowned, like a
yeah.
river that has a small tributary. If you take back that tributary back to the main river, then the river has more water.
Yes. And thank you for going into that, and thank you for the presentation. That was really a splendid piece of work, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. Thanks for sharing it, as well as congratulations on doing the work. So I want to move into our topic today to look at the first of the applications in the different niche areas, to look at your new money story. What I'd like you to do is to write down three questions. One, what's your money story? Two, what is a healthy relationship with money? And three, what would you ideally like your money story to be? Now, this is an introduction to a way of applying the interactions of mind and brain, impacting money behavior and financial decisions. My trademark concept is emotional economics. I really want to stimulate your reflections about money stories, beginning with your own, and to think about ways to listen to your clients' money stories. So listen to this description. and see how you're thinking about it. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's very personal with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story you talk about every day, think about several times a day, is remarkably simple yet at the same time intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue. It has a secret language. It has encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, and unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. You engage it every day of your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You may get 10 years out of a car, perhaps 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you still orient life decisions around it. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of your life story, from what you eat, drink, read, what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are impacted by this story. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your moods, to adjust self-esteem, influence others, or soothe emotional pains. The villain or the hero is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you, and you speak with it. It's your money or your money story. So, let's consider two money questions. The first one I ask, for you to think about at a time when you have just a little bit of time to reflect. What's your money story? Your money story is not your income, your assets, your debt, your bank account, or investment portfolio. Your money story is the unconscious tale you tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue about how much you feel you deserve, how much you feel you're worth, how much you feel you're capable of. It's also about what would happen if you had more or less. Now, here are some of the ways that we speak with money. And these are just to reflect on. And these are in your outline. We speak with money in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. The wonder of money is it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, yet fear and lack, for what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We use money to show how much we care or how little. We may use it to measure success or try to buy happiness. In other words, we use money to communicate. We also use money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, make it bigger than it is. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains, buy the respect of others, even at times ourselves. We use money as a self-statement. Money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statement. The story tells most about the teller. It can make statements for anyone, including proclamation of freedom, assurance of love, embodiment of power. These are different ways that people use as self-statements, affirmation of autonomy, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, to foster alliances or exclusions, an instrument of control. For example, we see a new car and want it. What we're really doing is acting out our money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that may say something like, well, this car is going to really prove what I'm worth. This will ease my struggles. People will respect me. This will validate me. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. And we use money in self-talk, another way we think about money. The messages we tell ourselves, these internal beliefs of self-talk may be people who have significant money are lucky. People who have money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't value or have money or wealth. Money really will buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. Our money stories are a large part of our life stories. Some of the money issues are really about money, but a lot are about other matters, private or in secret, that hitchhike on money. We take money, the tool, way too seriously most often. But we don't take our money stories seriously enough to recognize that we write them, live them, and can revise them. It's hard to get money just right. It may occupy too much of our lives or too little. Its importance may inhabit too large a space or too small. We may also use money in an inner dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create usual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not our age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you may not see the next dinner party. Ask how much debt you have, and you may not see dessert that evening. Recently, a writer at a writer's conference, an agent, a really well-known international agent, was speaking to a group of us about working with authors. Her topic was about how agents and authors collaborate and work together. And she talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. And ultimately, someone in the audience asked, would you talk about how much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? She looked shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you didn't talk about money. And she looked as if she were trying to compose herself. And an older gentleman in the back row said, this wasn't me, by the way, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course, he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion really useful to an audience, many of whom were interested in writing books for a living. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. And Grace, I know you know who that was. The year 1913. The therapist, Sigmund Freud. Over a century later, most of us have learned to talk more easily about sex, yet may remain seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own money stories. The first book I did about money had this quote on the front flap from Freud. The book was called The Last Taboo. And what spawned my interest at the time was I was asked to present or to be on a national panel looking at fees and psychotherapy. And I agreed to do it because I thought it would be interesting and I respected the well-known colleagues who were sitting with me. And I thought it would be easy to find some literature on this so I could ultimately know what I was talking about. Well, none existed. Actually, there was one book that was written about 20 years earlier at the time by a psychoanalyst, you know, from Europe, one of the original people, about the psychoanalysis of money. Nothing else was written. This was 1986, and or 85 or 86, when I did the panel, 86 by the time the book came out. I was amazed that this is something that psychoanalysts and therapists talk about every day, often with most patients about money and money issues and the emotional aspects of money, yet nothing was written about it. So we create internal and external conversations about money. We may not speak openly of something, but our internal voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before, for example, making a decision to exchange our money, our time and energy, for something else. And every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. The secret language is the one we speak to ourselves. The internal dialogue that's often silent is what we tell ourselves about money, the shadow story. Some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. When school started, I saw my classmates enjoying sodas and candies they purchased. I immediately joined them, and my treats were quickly gone. So I immediately thought, was that candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? This tells you how long ago it was. And will I get enough from this soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? I immediately answered no to both questions. So this is something that it helped me consider about what's the cost of money. You know, because we usually think about with our kids, we help them learn the value of money, perhaps like as I did with my kids, a clothes allowance, and then I became a collaborator rather than somebody that said no or yes to requests, so we could collaborate. And then when you earn money, and when they earned money, they began to appreciate what money cost, how much time and effort and energy it cost for that money. So it gave another dimension. Another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, "I'll give you what I never had as a child." The preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on an HD TV, but if I spread it out over the next 9 years, it only costs 22 cents a day. We regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money spent without debate. Salary or professional fee money, serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement, only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias because it's the same dollar. The dollar doesn't know who owned it any more than war bonds knew about the war. But the frame we place around it makes a difference of how we consider it and spend it. And this was from a documentary. The person said, "The high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy." And she was about to file her fourth bankruptcy at the time. Or the parent who says, "Spending money makes me feel like I'm providing for my family because I'm away at work a lot, so I want to buy my child something to make up for it." Now, another consideration, money speaks to us. Money sometimes speaks to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us as confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, or drug. It can serve as a tangible container for things like hope, freedom, ambition, love, disappointment. It can become any number of things, from a currency of caring or a symbol of success, a measure of power, any number of personal meanings. We make money mistakes because we use money to accomplish non-financial goals. We try to use money as the thing to do what no thing can actually do. Significantly and authentically regulate our moods, increase our self-esteem. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains and buy the respect of others. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it is. The more we give money meaning, the more we lose our focus on what it really means. And then we do strange things at times with money. Some examples. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly.
Yes.
Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise balanced individuals spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Otherwise dependable people can ignore financial matters until they become serious. Highly principled individuals can step over boundaries and write their own rules about money. I'm in Houston, home of Enron, home of Stanford. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to and changed. Why is our money story so important? Well, it permeates everything we do. It ghostwrites every aspect of our lives. Day by day, thought by thought, dollar by dollar, our money story becomes a significant portion of our life story. It's also important for another reason. The money story we each live will be the one that we teach our children, as well as our clients and our employees. We convey the model to our clients that they will download while we're talking about other things. When we talk about money, our experiences and ideas regarding money, we're really talking about ourselves. A money story reveals our relationship to ourselves as well as to money. So, let's look then at an aspect of this, the power of story in this regard. A study in which, and you may have heard of this story, a study in which volunteers had their brains scanned using fMRI when they tasted five Cabernet Sauvignon, each identified by different prices. Now, the volunteers knew the prices and knew which wine they were tasting and which price it was when they tasted it. So, they were asked then to rate it. The volunteers rated the wines according to the stated price. The cheapest wine tasted cheap. The most expensive wine was rated as everyone's favorite. And each sequentially along the line, 1 through 5. And the volunteers showed a corresponding increase in activity in their brains. In other words, their medial frontal orbital context, the pleasure center of the brain, was more active with the most expensive wine. And on down to the least. So their taste buds and their brains both agreed. Now, the volunteers actually tasted one wine with five different stories. They actually experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. Now, most recently, there was a study out of MIT that showed that more expensive placebos worked significantly better than cheaper placebos. So, you'll see in the workbook section of the curriculum three questions about money. Let's talk a little bit about your answer to number three, the question, money means to me. If you haven't done this, do it right now. Write down the one word that comes to mind, that first comes to mind about what money means to you. Now, this is to show how money can make any statement. And there are dozens of possibilities. Some of the most common: worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. And the desire is not quieted by its satisfaction. Desires can actually be created by filling them. Advertisers know this. Money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the inkblot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But when we're offered the chance to imbue the design with meaning, the interpretations are going to be as varied as each respondent. Now, in terms of money equations, people may think of money as, for example, a reflection of their self-worth or their morals. One woman said, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I should have good money. Well, money isn't related to morals. Action and a good plan gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Or their ethics. President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Well, now we know better than that. You may work hard, but overspend, gamble, have five kids, three of whom are college age, live in Midtown Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction, to name a few. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Of all groups, cultures, races, who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Any guesses? Grace, do you have a guess?
Filipinos.
Okay. Okay.
Because we know life was hard and here without opportunities. So here we take advantage of opportunities.
Okay. Okay. Well, that,
but I'm
that's
sure
good
the
guess.
Answer is different.
I've had guesses as I've done this presentation in different areas, but in Houston it's like shrimp boat operators or farmers.
Okay.
You know, there's one group, though, that trumps all of these. Who in America has the best work ethic? Heroin addicts.
Oh.
They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week and holidays. They can't let a single day go by without working. And one heroin addict put this way, tomorrow, if I don't get up at the crack of dawn and work all day, the next day, it's not my self-esteem that would suffer. The next day, I die. So they have to. So I mention that to distinguish work ethic from performance ethic and even success ethic. Because you've probably heard some, well, I was at my desk 8 or 10 hours today. Well, that's nice, but what about the performance ethic and the success ethic? How did you measure that? If you had that as a goal and had a plan, you probably could have been at your desk a fraction of that time. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a debt story. If money were about math, we wouldn't need to be talking. If it were about math, no one would have at least personal debt. But more than math, money is about emotions and psychology. It's about each individual money story. The average American family has 6 credit cards and carry an unpaid balance of more than $9,000. If any one of these families, if the average family, made the minimum payment on the credit card each month and didn't charge another dollar, payoff would occur at very close to one century from now. So the debt story can be an addictive world of spending and debt. Money has become more abstract, like using credit cards. So our debt has soared partly because of this. Money's become increasingly more abstract from, for example, a brief history of money, from using barter, you know, trading 2 sheep or 5 bags of rice for a particular thing or item of work, then to conch shells, then to coin, then to paper, and then to plastic, and then to an electron configuration. So it's become increasingly more abstract. As more abstraction occurs, our understanding of our relationship with money fades. The vast majority of money management occurs now in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring, and digitally. And, for example, when we use credit cards and move into that abstraction, that simple abstraction, we spend on average 23% more than by cash or check. Now, the important thing about your money story is to really discern what works and what doesn't. The components that work don't need fixing. The ones that don't work may need to be understood, roadmapped, in order to enhance both your money story and your life. To discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money, your life can be significantly changed by changing your money story. Now, here's an example about hitchhiking that applies to your professional services. The Wharton School of Business did an extensive survey of several thousand professionals to determine what was the primary reason that people signed on for professional services and what was the primary reason that people declined professional services after a recommendation and stating fees. The same reason was number one for both categories. So what do you think it was? Credentials? Reputation? Years of experience? Amount of the fee or state of the economy? Any guesses?
Confidence?
Yes. How'd you know that? You've been okay. You've heard me say that before. Exactly. It's the clarity and the confidence that the recommendation and the fees are stated. The credibility of professionals is hurt if they're fuzzy about fees or they don't feel that there's confidence because there is emotional contagion from midbrain to midbrain. And confidence is a state of mind, and states of mind are highly contagious. So for most people, the issue isn't about whether fees are high or low, but that the professional is clear, direct, and specific about the recommendation and the fear and the fee. So no matter how capable you are, clearly discuss your fees for your client to engage. Now, here's another example of how subliminal this conveyance can be. In a series of studies reported by Dan Gilbert at Harvard, he showed volunteers' words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was such a short time, 1/50th of a second, that they were unaware the words were shown and they couldn't even pick them out or guess from a multiple choice. This was subliminal programming. Yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, they would walk slightly slower. When the word stupid was flashed, they would perform slightly less well on tests. And this persisted for a period of 45 to 50 minutes after the word was flashed. Now, these volunteers were asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, and they always had some explanation. First of all, most of them denied it. They denied that they walked slower or performed less well. When it was shown to them, for example, they were shown a video before and after to show that they walked more slowly or they were given some valid evidence. So their denial was confronted. Those who gave way to this and acknowledged this came up with some story. Well, I've been jet-lagged, and I'm just tired. Or I haven't been sleeping well, or I've been preoccupied. They made it make sense. In other words, they brought closure to this uncertainty in their minds and brains. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. Now, these findings are one of many, many studies that demonstrate the desire that we have to bring closure, for the brain to end any dissonance, and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation. It infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness to be able to explain it in that way. Now, this is something that I think has also a direct application in our coaching. When you ask a question to a client, if it's a powerful question, you're probably perturbating a closed system. So what you want to listen carefully for is if your client truly answers your question or uses the question for a prompt to reiterate an aspect of their story or to free associate to the question. And that's an important distinction because if they don't answer the question, it's in the service of maintaining the story that they know and are familiar with, and they most likely aren't even aware that they're not answering the question. Let me give you one other example, a money example here. As an explorer, Columbus was an average sailor, but in one area, he was a genius. People believed in him. he projected a sense of confidence that was completely out of proportion to his means and his origin, a quiet and calm self-assurance. In fact, it was the same confidence usually shown by the nobility themselves. The powerful in the old-style aristocracies felt no need to prove or assert or sell themselves. Being noble, they felt entitled. They felt they deserved more, and they didn't even have to ask for it, usually. Columbus got full funding from the Queen of England to sail not just one, but three ships on the basis of an idea. And it, at the time, it was really a goofy idea, an eyebrow raiser and an eyeball roller combined, to find a new world. Yeah, right. But Columbus taught others how to respond to him by believing in himself. The most important person to convince about your professional fee, for example, is yourself. When you value your services, others will too. There is always a belief behind every statement of fee. And remember, it's up to you to set your own price. Ask for less, and that's exactly what you'll get. Ask for more, and you send a signal that you're worth it. Even those who may turn you down will respect you for your confidence, and that respect will pay off in ways that you might not right now be able to imagine. So, what's the role of mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The answer is everything. Now, we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience and quantum physics and strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operations. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. So, some groundbreaking research in psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, and neuroeconomics can teach us how to consciously and strategically direct our money decisions and how to outsmart our brains at times. We can strategically harness this chemistry and knowledge into wiring our brains to create wealth and success. How do our brains work against us at times in creating money stories? Well, the brain has a mind of its own, and we're of two or more minds, the emotional and the logical. Some examples. Each part struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Another example. A company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row. This quarter, they project earnings at 24 cents a share. Instead, they announce 1 penny less, 23 cents, even though it's still an increase and would be the 27th quarter. But because it's not quite expectation, in the next 5 minutes, they lose $1.5 billion in market value. Emotions can corrupt decision-making and cause a focus on the immediate. But on the other hand, those who feel no emotion are not good at making decisions. It has to be a balanced decision, right and left brain balance. And making people happy is not simply giving them more what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects them to continue. David Geffen said, anyone who believes money makes you happy really doesn't have money. And when someone's stock portfolio does well, they impute this to their talent and smartness. And it may be. But, for example, gamblers can interpret good fortune as skill. My wife and I play heads-up poker at times. And finally, after playing for a good while, she confessed to me that, asked me if she would like, if I would like her to tell me one of my major tells. And I said, of course. She said, when you happen to draw a really lucky hand, you have a slightly smug look, like you think you're brilliant. And I know that's true. the herding instinct of how our states of mind are vulnerable to emotion and contagion is a collective tilt. Money is like a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money is going to exaggerate. If someone's a problem drinker, it'll make them more drunk. If someone's insecure, money's going to make them more paranoid. If someone's caring and generous, it can help them become a better philanthropist. So it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. So, in summary then, we can roadmap a new money story. You have an example in the case study I sent around, and apply these 7 steps to understand your money story in order to create a new one that's successful and fulfilling. And the roadmap applies to this as well as many other aspects of our stories, and it can be usefully applied to a money story to see where you are with that or if it's useful to work with a client. So, any thoughts or questions or clarifications about any of this? I compressed a lot of things into my discussion. Thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I don't know. It's probably a conversation for another time, but you mentioned fees. Right now, I don't really know how much to charge exactly yet. How do we determine that?
How will you go about that? What is your thought right now? So I'm asking you, how will you decide? Are you going to look at what others cost or charge, or how will you decide, Grace?
Well, I think for one thing, what others charge is another gauge, but also what I'd like to charge is another, and perhaps somewhere between the two, I'll
okay.
come up with something.
There is a blog at the Coach Training Alliance website. If you go to www.coachtrainingalliance.com, and I think the far right tab at the top is blog, and look several down, and there's a blog that I did about fees in professional coaching or professional coaching fees, and it's the 9 most common mistakes that we make in setting and collecting professional fees. I don't remember which is first, but the first one should be looking at what others charge, because most people charge too little. So here's one formula. There are only 3 variables in terms of fee: what you charge, how much you make, let's say on a yearly basis, and how much you work. So decide what the 2 most important are and give them numbers. For example, if you decide you want to generate $200,000 a year from coaching clients, if you decide you want to work 11 months and have 15 clients meeting on a weekly basis, then you simply do the math. You charge a monthly retainer of $1,215. Now, we know that there are ways to leverage your time significantly more than that, to do coaching groups, to do seminars, to have products, to do facilitation. The facilitations that you do may be, $4,000 to $6,000 a day. Think about all the ways you can leverage your time and impact, as well as money. Coaching groups, you can offer coaching groups for significantly less than that, make more money yourself, but offer a much lesser fee and have a significant benefit to people who want, rather than the individual confidential work, they want to work in a group and want the camaraderie and the support and the development of group wisdom and hearing other people who going through something similar and looking at what's worked and not worked. So that's a one use that probably more people who have done this training have made use of the client workbook in that way, by giving people in the group a copy, and it can be co-branded with your name on the cover. You know, so that's one way of doing that. So that's just a beginning answer to the to see what you know, to apply that formula and see what you come up with.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're out of time. Thanks very much. And if those of you who weren't in attendance have questions, jot them down and we'll bring them to Focus next time. Remember, we will not meet, as we discussed earlier, the week of Thanksgiving. So we'll be right back here in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Have a great holiday.
Thank you, Dave. You
see
too.
You guys. Look forward to picking up again. Bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.